It's Late Night Week on Fresh Air. One of the big late night changes scheduled for early next year is Seth Meyers moving to NBC's Late Night, replacing Jimmy Fallon when Fallon moves to The Tonight Show. Meyers has been Saturday Night Live's head writer and co-anchor or anchor of Weekend Update since the fall of 2006. We're going to listen back to an excerpt of the interview I recorded with Seth Meyers in October 2008. It was the week after the broadcast in which he did a hysterical bit on Weekend Update about the financial meltdown.
On Thursday, your grandfather finally admitted that he screwed up the economy. While speaking before Congress on Thursday, Alan Greenspan, former chairman of the Federal Reserve, said he was shocked his ideas led to the current economic crisis and said, "I still do not understand exactly how it happened." Well, let me see if I can give it a shot. Banks bundled mortgages that had been given to people that wouldn't even qualify for jury duty and then sold those along with credit default swaps, which are basically insurance that the seller provides to the buyer in case the entity loses value. However, unlike regular insurance, these swaps weren't regulated, so they failed to meet any standards of responsible business. Then when everything collapsed, it spread like an infection, because when people are making money, they don't ask how. They just say, "Yay," but again, you're the expert.
That was excellent. I have to say, I thought that was a wonderful one-paragraph description of what happened to the economy. So did you consult economists before writing that?
I would have to give my thanks to Steve Croft in 60 Minutes, because they did a piece on it about 3 weeks ago. And then I was very happy to see this Sunday they did a follow-up piece to it. So I felt like I had gotten there a day early talking about it in this cycle. But that was the piece that I sort of saw that explained it to me, so I will give credit where credit's due.
So what's the process like of writing for Weekend Update? Like, how much time do you have to follow the news? What are your main news sources?
Well, I sort of spend my first half of the week focusing on the rest of the show as sort of the head writer of the rest of the show, and we have three incredibly talented Weekend Update writers, Doug, Alex, and Jessica, who do all the joke writing. And then the rest of the staff will write jokes as well sort of later in the week, and I will write some jokes as well. Like, I wrote that Greenspan joke, but I think that may have been the only joke that I had written this past Saturday. But we get together on Friday night, and we read a bunch of jokes, and it's almost 800 jokes. And we cut that down to about 100 that we like, and then Doug, who produces it, cuts it down to about 30. And, you know, it ends up being around, 18 to 20 jokes come Saturday night.
Do you feel different doing Weekend Update than you felt when you were a cast member doing impressions of people, you know, Ryan Seacrest, John Kerry?
Oh, absolutely. Here's the thing about me, and I hate to let this secret out. I have very little range as a performer. So for me to sit behind a desk and tell jokes, that is way closer to sort of what I was doing before I was on Saturday Night Live. And I feel a lot more comfortable doing that. So I also, as a writer, you know, when I started on the show, you know, one of the jobs of the cast members, you sort of write for yourself. And, you know, I enjoyed that a great deal, but becoming head writer and getting to write for everybody else is way more liberating.
What is the job of the head writer?
The best way to describe it is you're sort of the... all the writers are surgeons, and you're the emergency room doctor. It's just triage. The thing that most needs attention, you sort of have to drop everything and sort of give a hand to. So as head writer, you know, you just sort of, I run a rewrite table with all the writers where we sit around and pitch jokes based on what's already written. But each writer sort of gets to usher their piece through from, you know, the beginning stages to the final, you know, when it airs. Each individual writer casts their piece. They talk to set design. They talk to wardrobe. The most fun is between dress and air. If Lorne sort of needs a minute out of a piece as a head writer, you sort of get to go sit down with the writer and try to find how you're going to take a minute out of something. It's when it moves the fastest, it's when it's the most fun.
You're in the position of having to tell people no also, to tell a writer, this isn't going to make the final cut.
I'm so glad that that's actually not true, because it really is the greatest process, where between dress and air, everything's on a note card. And when Lorne calls the meeting between dress and air, you walk in, and it's like finding out if you made the high school play or not. Your note card is either on the air side or on the cut side. So I actually very rarely have to give bad news. I'm just in the room when I see people's faces register the bad news.
Do you remember the very first time you heard Don Pardo say your name?
I do. It was the craziest thing ever.
I should say Don Pardo's the announcer on Saturday Night Live. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I started my first show was the first show after 9/11.
That was your
first
show.
That was my first show, which was a crazy time to be starting on the show. And the only sketch I was in, I played a fish's head, a floating fish's head, which means I had to wear a green leotard because I was in front of a green screen. And my face had to be painted green. So I was in a green leotard with a face painted green, wearing a bathrobe, standing next to a bunch of police officers and firemen. The first time I heard Don Pardo say my name, and I realized that with everything that was happening in the world, it was the most insignificant part of the night. But it was, for me, incredible.
Seth Meyers, it's really been fun to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Seth Meyers is Saturday Night Live's head writer and anchor of Weekend Update. He'll become the new host of NBC's Late Night early next year after Jimmy Fallon leaves for The Tonight Show. Our interview was recorded in 2008. You can download podcasts of our late night series on our website, freshair.npr.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. Our blog is on Tumblr at nprfreshair.tumblr.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our assistant producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, providing reviews of local roofers, painters, landscapers, and plumbers to keep the consumer informed. More at angieslist.com. From Chevrolet, maker of the Bolt, an electric car also powered by gas to help drivers go the distance and then some. Details at chevyvolt.com. And from Novo Nordisk, committed to diabetes care and changing lives for more than 90 years. NovoNordisk-US.com. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, our late night week concludes with Questlove, who leads The Roots, the house band on Late Night with Jimmy Fallon. They're moving with Fallon to The Tonight Show. When we spoke, Questlove was writing the new Tonight Show theme and was a little stressed.
Boy, I'm having these nightmares of waking up in the middle of the night.
Join us.
Education is the theme for the September TED viewing at your public library. First, Sir Ken Robinson on principles crucial for the human mind to flourish. Then, the head of the Program for International Student Assessment will speak about results in different nations. And finally, Salman Khan, whose tutoring of a cousin led him to create the YouTube channel The Khan Academy, which now has 1 million subscribers. That's TED, September 26th at the Downtown Library, with refreshments provided by the Friends of the Juneau Public Library.
Support for this program comes from Balloons by Night Moods, providing balloon creations for birthdays, weddings, and other events. More information at 523-1099 or nightmoodsjuneau.com. Night Moods, a proud sponsor of public radio in Juneau.
Time now is 3 o'clock, and you're listening to a Juneau Afternoon on KTOO for Thursday, August 29th. I'm your host, Lisa Fu. We'll talk to Richard Council and Pat Bellick about the upcoming Argentine Tango Workshop. James Witkoff will be here to highlight next week's community garage sale. We'll learn about Alaska Native Language classes at UAS with guest Lance Twitchell, and Nancy DeCherney will be here with Arts Up. That, Writer's Almanac, music, and more, all on today's Juneau Afternoon. First is National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Wild rice season is set to begin in northern Wisconsin. The traditional food of native people in the area typically ripens around Labor Day. But as WXPR's Natalie Jablonski reports, harvesters may need extra patience this year.
Only 3 of about 50 lakes regulated by state and tribal officials will open for ricing this weekend. Manuman biologist for the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, Lisa David, says Wisconsin's late spring delayed ripening in some areas.
There's a lot that is still late, and so we just want to get across the idea that people should go out and really look at the bed before they start knocking rice. Because you can damage the rice by trying to knock off green rice that's not ready.
Checking for ripeness is especially important in waters that don't have a set opening date. Those make up the majority of the more than 300 Wisconsin lakes that host wild rice, where it's up to individual harvesters to determine if the grains are ready. The Department of Natural Resources wetland habitat biologist Jason Fleener says though the season may be late, he's expecting it to be slightly more productive than last year.
Over the last few years, the rice harvest has not been great. There's really mixed results across the state. Some lakes are complete failures in terms of rice, and then some are above average, so it's really a mixed bag.
Lac du Flambeau spokesman Brandon Tome says his tribe is concerned about the long-term trend of smaller harvests.
Recent years, our wild rice crops have been diminishing, and it's a great concern of our community and the Ojibwe Nation as a whole. You know, it was a staple of our existence and a spiritual food.
The Lac du Flambeau Tribal Council is monitoring wild rice beds on the reservation, but has not yet given the go-ahead for harvesting. So far, about 20 off-reservation lakes have been declared closed to wild rice harvesting for the season. For National Native News, I'm Natalie Jablonski in Rhinelander, Wisconsin.
A federal court ruling means a tribal casino in Oklahoma will have to shut down this week. As KGOU's Kurt Gortney reports, the decision eliminates the tribe's major economic resource.
The United Kituwa Band of Cherokee Indians is out of time after operating a casino in Oklahoma for more than 2 decades. The tribe lost what appears to be its last legal battle this week when the 10th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Denver ruled the Kituwas did not meet the requirements to stop a lower court's ruling. The federal court in Tulsa, Oklahoma, earlier decided the tribe's land was not in trust, which made its casino illegal under Oklahoma law. As many as 150 workers could lose their jobs if the gaming center closes. The casino is the primary source of revenue for the Kituwa Band of Cherokees. The smaller tribe runs its casino in the historic capital of the larger Cherokee Nation, an ongoing source of tension between the two tribes. Cherokee Nation Principal Chief Bill John Baker has made overtures to allow the gaming operation to continue, either through a lease arrangement or the development of a new casino. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Gwartney in Oklahoma City.
Reservations on the Northern Plains continue to deal with a long heat wave. Triple-digit temperatures are expected in some locations for the next several days. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt reports.
South of North Dakota, Minnesota, Iowa, and other states are sweltering this last week of August. One weather official says it could be the hottest such period on record. The culprit is a large area of high pressure that has to this point refused to budge. It's joined by what's called a monsoonal flow, which makes hot temperatures even more uncomfortable. Heat indices have reached 105 degrees or more in many locations. Lake Andy, South Dakota, on Yankton Sioux tribal land, is forecast to hit the upper 90s over the next few days, while Pine Ridge is forecast for a high of 100. Forecasters say a short cooling trend could hit the region by Labor Day weekend, followed by more heat in early September. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbolt.
During this month in 1957, Seminole people voted to create the Seminole Tribe of Florida. The vote established a governmental entity and a chartered corporation to conduct economic development for the tribe. The tribe now owns several businesses, and it has fought for sovereignty and self-determination to retain Seminole language, culture, and way of life. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon on KTOO. I'm your host, Lisa Fu. And right now we have in the studio Richard Council and Pat Bielek. Welcome.
Thank you.
So tell me, why are you guys here?
Well, we are sponsoring, meaning Juno International Folk Dancers and the Dance Loft are sponsoring Richard to come back and teach Argentine tango again. So he has come up 4 years, 5 years, and we are so excited for him to come back.
Wow.
That kind of rejuvenates our tango community.
Oh, that's great. How large is the tango community in Juno?
Well, that's a good question. I would say anywhere from 10 to 30 at any given event.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you've, Richard, you've been coming back to Juno for a few years now.
I live down in South Florida, so I come down maybe once a year or so. And the idea is to give intensive instruction spread out over 2 weeks. So the main focus is talking about a variety of subjects within the dance itself. So you're learning not only the fundamentals of the vocabulary, but also how to incorporate it with music, how to understand a bit of the dance culture of the dance, giving everybody sort of a well-rounded understanding of the fundamentals. So it's really, a lot of people can get involved in it, different levels of experience, everybody from somebody just starting out to people who have been dancing it for years.
Okay, so how do you mix different levels of abilities? You're saying that beginners are welcome as well as advanced. So how do you mix them?
It's a challenge, but the thing is that through, well, it's like experience teaching, of course, but a lot of it is approaching it, the subject through an element, and then trying to develop the element from there to get an idea of what the group is capable of, and coming with a good lesson plan and development from the ground up of whatever that idea might be.
Okay, so you're saying someone who has never tangoed before. How about someone who has never danced before?
We all got to start somewhere.
Great. Wow. That's awesome. Okay, so this is called Argentine tango. Is
yes.
Argentine tango different than other types of tango?
It is. And it can be good to have experience in any kind of dance, whether it's American tango or international tango or Argentine tango, or even people who dance salsa or swing or ballroom in general. The main thing is that this dance is focused on the connection between found within the couple. Your goal is not to necessarily show off to the whole room, to the judge who might be 3 acres away, trying to impress them with as big a movement as you can, but more to understand the language of the dance. So if you have any kind of background with it, that's great. But if you don't, everybody starts out not knowing anything, and the idea is to make it open to everybody.
Okay, is there something particular about Argentine tango that's like, if people have done tango before, is there something different about Argentine tango?
Well, you mean if they've danced tango before?
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of what I'll be talking about is, well, of course, concept,
okay,
but also understanding the structure of it. It's easy to just say, well, look elegant or look like you're having a good time or do this, but my main focus is to understand how to connect and what is the structure behind movement, mm-hmm, and then also how is this going to work in the social dance floor, and how is this going to work with music based off of the different orchestras that you're listening to, because you don't always dance the same type of tango to each song that you hear, but that's the beauty of it, and you can dance it all night long, and anywhere you go you're going to find tango all over the country, all over the world, Juneau, Alaska, all the way down to where I'm from in South Florida, and everywhere in between. It's really a wide range.
Okay. What sort of footwear or clothes do you wear when you dance tango?
That's a good question, because a lot of times people come in with rubber-soled shoes or something like that, or things that'll slip off the heel, and that does present certain challenges. Tango is an elegant dance, so sometimes people like to get dressed up for that sort of thing, but that doesn't mean you necessarily have to. The main thing is that you're a shoe that stays on the foot. If ladies are wearing heels, for example, something that holds onto the heel, and then guys to have a leather-soled shoe so that so that your foot doesn't get stuck on the floor when you try to swivel or do any footwork where you have to roll your ankle or anything. That would be bad.
Okay, so it could be casual. You don't have to wear a dress if you're female.
No.
Okay, but the footwear is. What if women don't want to wear heels?
Something that will swivel. Something that will not stick to the floor. The main thing is you want to be comfortable. That's the main thing, because then you'll really be able to have a good time.
Okay, great. Richard, what makes you qualified to teach Argentine tango?
Well, I've been teaching for, I guess 14 years now. And I've taught in festivals around the country. I've toured, competed. I'm a U.S. title holder from 2003. I traveled down to the World Championships in Argentina in 2005, competed there. That doesn't necessarily, and performed all over the place, but these things don't necessarily make one a good teacher. In order to be a teacher, you have to study not only the subject of dancing, in my case, but also to understand how to teach and how to convey a thought and how to convey an idea. Because, of course, I'm working with people of varying levels of experience, and it's always a challenge, but this constant practice, you can see from teacher to teacher, and that's why it's important to work with different teachers too, not just stay with one guy or one girl. But as far as credentials, a lot of it is the workshops, traveling around the country. I'm on the road most of the time, and people, I get return students, so that's a good thing.
And it seems like you enjoy it.
I love it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Pat, were you ever a student of his?
Oh, yeah. Every time he comes up here.
Uh-huh.
Part of tango is very unique, and until you have experienced it, you really don't really understand what that is. But there's a phrase that has always captured me. They said that every dance with tango, you fall in love with your partner for those 3 minutes. Because you are so focused on your partner, you don't know what's coming from one movement to the next. And whether it's a basic movement or a really fancy one, you stay with that partner, and it is such an incredible experience. And every woman in Juneau who has danced with Richard has gone, oh, my God, that was so good. And every guy who hasn't danced with Richard but looks at him going like, oh, how do I get there? How do I get there?
I'm going to come to Juneau more often. That's true.
So it's a very special learning process, and it's very centering, meaning that you don't have to feel like you've got to stay up with someone else. It is very you and your partner. So when Richard said that, it's very unique compared to a lot of the other dances.
Okay, so before we get into the details, because we should share those, do you have to do this workshop with a partner, or can you come alone?
No, you can come by yourself, and it works both ways. If you have a partner you'd like to work with, come with your partner. If you're coming in as a solo dancer, that's great too, because what I like to do is change partners so you get a chance to try out dancing with a variety of flavors of people.
Mm.
But if you don't want to change partners, you don't have to change partners.
Well, just thinking about Pat's comment. Okay, let's go over the details then.
Okay, well, it starts this Friday. We have 14 sessions. They're all taking place at the Filipino Hall, which is on South Franklin. They have a dance studio up on the second floor. So that's where they're all taking place. Friday night starts at 7. On Saturday, we have 3 sessions starting at 12:30. On Sunday, we have 2 sessions at 1:30, and then we're heading up to the top of the tram for a milonga. So the Timberline Bar and Grill up there is hosting our dance, a milonga being a dance, and they're putting down a wood floor for us to enjoy the evening, starting around 6:30. And it'll end by the time we come down on the last tram ride at 9:30. And then Tuesday night at 7. And then next weekend, we start the whole thing again, Friday at 7. Saturday, we'll start at 10 in the morning. And then Sunday at 1:30, and Tuesday again at 7 before Richard takes off.
Okay, and how can someone do these workshops? Just show up, or do you have to
register? Just show up. We will take registration before each class. So the first one, again, is coming a little early on Friday before 7 would be great. The cost is $20 a session unless you take little packages, like the weekend, all 6 classes is $100, and if you take pay for both weekends, it's $170.
Okay, so you can do all sessions or some of the sessions?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay, great. Well, thank you both for coming in so much. Thank you, Richard and Pat. If you want to fall in love, do the Argentine Tango Workshop. listening to a Juno Afternoon on KTOO News. I'm Lisa Fu, your host for this afternoon, and in the studio we have James Wyckoff. Welcome, James.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
So, tell me, why are you here today?
Well, I'm the volunteer coordinator for the Juno Community Garage Sale. This is the 18th annual.
Wow.
And it's just a fun time. It's about 10 days from now. It's the first Saturday in September. That'd be September the 7th. And you want me to just go ahead and kind of lay out what it is for people that aren't familiar with the garage sale?
Yeah, sure. What is the community garage sale?
It's like a 40 to 50 family garage sale, all at Centennial Hall in Out of the Weather.
Great.
And it's very useful for people that don't have a good venue for a garage sale. People live in apartments or condos or boats, that sort of thing, you know. For $26, what it is, we just everybody shares the cost of renting the ballroom at the Centennial Hall. And we figure that out to about $26. So the fee for a space at the community garage sale is $26. For $26, you get an 8x10 space with a table and a chair. And each space is large enough to accommodate two tables if a person wanted a second table. And Centennial Hall charges $3 extra for a second table in a space there. And you're welcome to bring tables from home, but for $3, most people find it pretty handy to have a table set there waiting for them and don't have to take it home, and it leaves more room in the car or the SUV or whatever to haul stuff down. And so we open up the doors at 6 o'clock in the morning on Saturday morning for people to start bringing their stuff in. And they have 3 hours till 9 o'clock in the morning. And then we open up the doors to the public to come in. And it's the garage sale starts at that point. And it's just a gas. It's a family event. No guns, no alcohol, no live animals, no food. It's basically a garage sale. And so it goes on to 1 o'clock. Now, several people, it's happened to me twice, I've been able to sell everything on my table before noon.
Wow.
But the garage sale goes on to 1 o'clock, then it's over. Then can't leave anything behind. You have to take anything that you don't sell, you have to take home with you. Or drop it off at the Salvation Army or wherever you like. You can't leave it at the Centennial Hall. And it's just a fun time. And, of course, during those 3 hours from 6 to 9, the people at house spaces get to preview everybody else's stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And swap and sell that way, too. So that is the basic outline of it.
That's kind of dangerous. You go to get rid of your stuff, and you probably end up acquiring more stuff from other tables.
Yeah, there's always such good deals there. It's hard to walk away from them, you know.
Bring home another garage full of stuff.
Yeah.
So how are are people already part of this, or can families still join the sale?
Yes, we have some spaces left over. We normally do it in October. Centennial Hall had a major event going on for the weekend in October that we normally had it. They asked if we could move it to September. We said, sure, no problem, you know. So right now there's several spaces left, and you can find the application. Well, what I need to do is receive an application from the person and a check so that I can lay their spot out on the floor plan. Each individual is assigned a particular place in the ballroom for their stall, you might say. Only it's not a stall, it's just an area with a table. And you can go on Facebook, and our site there on Facebook is Juno Community Garage Sale, all one word, and the application pops up there, and you can print it out, or you can go to my Facebook page, James Wyckoff, that's JamesWyckoff, all one word, and there's a link to the garage sale there, or you can just call over Centennial Hall, and they'll email you an application, and then anybody's welcome to call me anytime at 586-6393. If I'm not there, leave a message. I'll get back. I've been the pharmacist in town for 38 years. So to give the youngsters off, I'm going to be working out at the Walmart pharmacy. I guess it's all right for me to mention a store name on Labor Day. So if anybody wants to drop by an application there,
okay.
I'll do that too.
Okay, so spaces are still available, but they should get a hold of you as soon as possible, I'm sure, because you need to plan out the space.
That's exactly right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Having to drag your stuff over, you can't always bring probably all the items that you'd like to bring. What are some of the biggest items that you've seen in years past that people brought?
Last year, a guy sold a 28-foot sailboat, but he didn't bring it to the garage sale.
He didn't bring it inside Centennial Hall.
Right. He bought a photo album of it, they got together with somebody there, and later went down to the boat and worked out the deal. Another fellow bought this wasn't last year, but years previous, one of the sellers had a baby crib. It was just too cumbersome to bring down to the Centennial Hall, so he brought the photograph, and sure enough, somebody come along and said, we're going to need a baby crib here pretty soon. And so they got together. The great thing about a garage sale, everybody goes away happy. If two people, one person's got the item, other person has a need for the item, they come together on what the value of that item should be, and they're both happy if the deal is made. If they can't agree on that, well, they both walk away happy because they just had different sets of values.
Right, yeah.
And so it's a kind of a win-win-win situation there, you might say.
A win-win-win.
Yeah.
And it's kind of great for the buyers. It's kind of a one-stop shop.
That's right.
Instead of driving around on Saturday, just
right
there.
For people who've been in Juneau for a while, they know that garage sailing in Juneau is a sport.
Yes, exactly. And sometimes the weather doesn't always cooperate.
Well, that's exactly right.
Yeah. So that's...
And, whenever you can get a six-family garage sale in a cul-de-sac, you just hit a gold mine there. Well, this is that in spades, you might say.
Wow, great. Okay, anything else you want to add? Or
some of the fundraisers, some of the local community organizations use the garage sale as a fundraiser, and they generally just have things that are donated to them. The Grateful Dogs of Juneau are going to be there. It's one of my favorite groups. The Helping Hands is going to be there. And, I think they're going to be there, put it that way. Let's see who else. Oh, yes, a lady that represents a home down in Mexico. She volunteers there and to fund that. What it is for youngsters that live in the villages in Mexico, they don't have the educational availability as the villages in Alaska do.
Mm-hmm.
So they run this home to have the kids come in from the villages to, and that's their home to attend high school and go on to college, and they can stay in that home while they're attending college and university, and then hopefully take some of that skill back to the village there to help out. But it's just a very worthwhile organization, and let's see, can't think right offhand what some of the the Rotary Club's going to be selling their bulbs there.
Okay.
And let's see, there's going to be lots of fishing gear for the guys. And one person mentioned they're going to have an antique oak table from the 20s that has wicker trim on it. And another person's bringing some collector stamps. And ask him, what do you call a stamp collector? And he didn't know. For those people that do collect stamps, this may be some new collectible stamps for the Juneau area.
Yes,
that come out of somebody's inheritance. Who knows?
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so it's just a lot of fun that way.
Yeah, okay. So it sounds like there's going to be a lot going on, buying, selling, some fundraising going on.
Yes, exactly.
Well, thank you so much, James, for coming in and sharing that information. Doors open on September 7th at what time?
At 9 o'clock for the public, at 6 o'clock for the sellers.
Centennial Hall, and there's still space available to be part of, to sell your stuff. Right. And why don't you give your number?
586-6393.
And there's also a Facebook page?
At Juno Community Garage Sale. And a link from my Facebook page at James Wyckoff, or they can call Centennial Hall.
Great. Well, thank you, James.
Stuff. No matter what it cost me, I couldn't get enough. Got to put it all behind me, got to give it all up. I ended up with too much stuff. Had to get more money, took a trip to the bank. Said I'm running on empty, put a tiger in my tank. I got a brand new guitar on a big TV. Got a house in the country and a DVD. I ended up with too much stuff. No matter what it cost me, I couldn't get enough. Got to put it all behind me. I got to give it all up. I ended up with too much stuff. Got stuff from the doctor, and the doc ain't cheap. Got stuff to wake me up, they give me stuff to make me sleep. Got stuff to make me happy, got stuff to make me thin. And when I get out of it, they give me stuff to get me in. I ended up with too much stuff. No matter what it cost me, I couldn't get enough. I got to put it all behind me, got to give it all up. I ended up with too much stuff. Brother Hubert.
To Juno Afternoon on KTOO. Right now we have Lance Twitchell online by phone. Lance, you're on air.
All right. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for joining us today.
You bet.
So we're here to talk to you today about Alaska Native Language classes at UAS.
Yes, that's correct.
So what languages are being taught?
Right now we're teaching one level of Haida, so we're teaching an intermediate Haida class, and then we're teaching actually four levels of Tlingit. So with Tlingit there's beginning, intermediate, advanced, and then the Tlingit literature class as well.
Okay, and who's teaching these classes?
So the beginning and advanced classes are taught by Marcia Hotch. And she's one of our longest tenured instructors. She's been here with us for a long time. And she's teaching the beginning and intermediate. And we also have Robbie Littlefield, who's teaching a distant section of the beginning Tlingit class out of Sitka. And then I'm teaching intermediate Tlingit and Tlingit oral literature. And we're really excited to have Ben Young teaching Haida for us.
Wow. Okay, so how long have you been speaking Tlingit?
I've been speaking Tlingit for about 18 years now. And so I started when I was about 20. And I didn't know a single word before I got started. It was something I spent a lot of time with my grandfather, and I thought, you know, I knew he spoke Tlingit. He was probably the only one in our family that really did. And so I just said, hey, you know, teach me Tlingit. And he'd start to point at things and say it like salt. You know, he'd say, ache. And I would try to say that, and he would just laugh at me, you know, because I couldn't say it, because that's just his personality. And then, but it just, it formed a bond between us. And then he passed away shortly after that, and then the language was sort of my lasting connection with him.
Oh, wow. So tell me again, how old were you when you started?
I was about 20.
Oh, which is quite late to start learning a new language. I mean, it's not late, but often, you know, we hear that learning language is easiest when you're young.
Right.
What is your proficiency level at this point?
Well, you know, I would say I'm an advanced learner, is how I would put it. In Tlingit, there's probably about 5,000 to 6,000 verbs, so it's a lot of work to just continue learning verbs. But I can, you know, stay in conversations for quite a while. There's lots of stuff where I can hear it, and maybe I'll have to go listen to it again to figure out what it is. I'm certainly nowhere near, you know, but the thing that I try to do is to bridge our students with our fluent elders, and, you know, and just give them, it gives everybody relief. And for the students, it shows them that they can start to make these accomplishments and become speakers. And for our elders, they're just so lonely for language right now because there's so few speakers that, you know, we really try to link them up and say, you know, when you guys see each other in the community, you speak Tlingit. And that's one of the goals, is trying to push the language program beyond the classroom, and also to take some of these sort of these mythologies that it's harder when you're an adult, and it's true, but it's certainly not impossible. Anybody could do it.
Oh, of course.
You know, and so the big difference is if you learn from birth, you just sort of internalize grammar intuitively. But then once you have a grammatical structure in your brain, you got to sort of break that down and build it back up a little bit, and then just do tons of listening and lots of listening, and then some talking. And the big thing is learning how to eventually let go of that side that always wants to interpret.
Oh, so what made you, at age 20, want to learn?
So it was really just sort of a way to bond with my grandfather. And then as I went to college, I started to figure out that there was very few speakers of the language. And then once I sort of, you know, it was a combination of things of bonding with my grandfather, and then also once I figured out what the state of indigenous languages are around the world, but especially in North America, then that's when I figured out that, you know, it was something I had to do. And it became more of a, instead of a just a personal connection between two people or between me and my culture, which I began to realize, you know, if you don't know your language, you know, you may know tons and tons about culture, but unless you know the language, everything is a translation of the culture. And so within the language, you find all the reasons for different things being. And so it just became more and more of an interest. And then as I began to especially bond with elders who just have a tremendously kind hearts and want you to succeed, I found that there was nothing in the world that could replace what I felt when I was around them and when I was making those personal successes that were resulting in being able to just communicate in the language.
Wow. When you talk, you mentioned the state of indigenous languages in this country and around the world. What is the state of indigenous languages?
It's pretty grim. You've got some languages like various dialects of Yupik and Chupik, which are generally pretty strong in Alaska. You know, they've got, you know, and in some communities it's upwards of 90% that speak. They are the very rare exception. And so outside of those communities, you know, Inuit is, you know, probably around 15%. And then from there you get, you know, generally lower in Alaska to, and Tlingit and Haida and Tsimshian are all under 1% of their population that can speak. And then if we look at the total population, it's also, you know, if you had all of Juneau, you would say like 0.5% could speak. If you took all the Tlingit speakers in the world and moved them to Juneau, we would be 0.5% of the population of Juneau. So we're really in a tough situation. There are some languages that have really high percentages, like Kaska and Northern Inuit. And then there are others that are just doing good just on the basis of having a sheer high number of people, so like Cherokee and Navajo, where they have lots and lots of speakers, but maybe they only have 40-50%, maybe even 20% of their population who speaks, but you know, they're just a much bigger nation.
When people think about learning a language, I mean, I think this all the time. It's going to be hard. It's going to be difficult. And I'm sure you talk to potential students who want so badly to learn, but, you know, there's a fear involved of not succeeding. And you said that when you first started learning with your grandfather, he laughed at you a lot.
Right.
I experienced that with my mother in trying to learn Chinese and her frustration. And it was difficult. I mean, how do you overcome those barriers? Of people laughing at you, or, you know, just thinking you sound silly.
Right. And so there's a number of things that we do. Is one, we try to do some ceremony and preparation to say, you know, the classroom is a place where the language was beaten from us, but we're going to reclaim that space and make it our own. And we emphasize that it's a very safe place, and it's a place where it's okay to be wrong. It's okay to, you know, you might say something that's supposed to be feather, and it's not like fart, because they sound very close to one another. So it's easy to sort of, you know, embarrass yourself at times, but we really just encourage that, you know, if you're making mistakes, it probably means that you're just trying. Mm. And so we do a lot to sort of build up that safe place. We eat together. We spend a lot of time, you know, just sort of, sometimes we'll just talk about what it means to have language loss, and we get tremendous, some stories that have tremendous sorrow. And, you know, we don't run away from that. We really, we talk about that. We figure out what we can do as a group of people about that. Because when it comes down to it, we're just people. And so we can figure out the problems that other people have created. And then the other thing is we bring our elders in. You know, those are the magic that they have, and the wisdom, the spirituality, that connection between us and our ancestors. And they give them words of encouragement over and over and over. And then it's also a place where we can laugh. We can laugh at ourselves. We try to be careful, so that you're not humiliating somebody. But, you know, sometimes we just have fun with the language. There's so much humor in our languages. And, you know, there was this elder I was talking to up in, Carcross and, this summer. And he was saying, you know, we used to talk about these old timers that go around and clink it, and it's like they were just looking for somebody to laugh with. He says he was sitting around with his friends. He's like, all they do is go around and find friends and laugh at. And then he said, pretty soon we realize we're doing the same thing. You know, so there's a real healing power in some of that laughter. You know, and so we're looking at genocide right in the face. And we're saying, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to succumb to that. And it's not just Tlingit people, it's not just Haida people, it's not just Tsimshian people, but we're hoping that our entire community is going to reform and awaken to what has happened and the results of it, and to say, we're your people, we can figure it out, and we can be united in this journey of becoming speakers. And it'll, you know, one of my dear colleagues, he said, you know, you got to look at the top three things in your life and push one of them aside and replace it with language. Hmm. And that's, you know, that's how you become a speaker. And there's a lot of people who struggle and they say, you know, I'm just not getting it. And the reality is they probably come to class, which is 4 hours a week, and that might be about it. You know, maybe they'll pick something up for, you know, a little bit here and there. But the ones who became speakers, we just, for hours, every single day, we're listening to it or we're talking. You know, I used to walk around campus of the University of Minnesota with flashcards and just practice. And that's what I did. And, you know, I was waiting in line, I was on the bus, and that's what you can do.
Okay, Lance, before we run out of time, let's go over some details. When do classes start?
So classes start up on Tuesday, and we've got classes 5 nights a week out at the university. Beginning Clinkit goes Monday and Wednesday nights, so that first class would be Wednesday. Intermediate Clinkit goes Tuesday and Thursday nights. Advanced Clinkit goes Tuesday and Thursday, and Clinkit Oral Literature goes on Fridays. And we really encourage people, if they've studied Clinkit, to come back. If you haven't spoken it for a while and you feel like you're losing it, then come back. And the other thing is there's, and we have our intermediate HIDA classes on Mondays and Wednesdays taught by, Ben Young. It's a distance class. All of those classes we've listed, you could call in from, you know, if you live in Juneau, you have to go to the class. But if you lived in, you know, Sitka or France or you know, New York City, wherever, you could call in from, you know, you just got to make that time to call in.
Okay. And how do people register?
And to register, you can go to uas.alaska.edu, and you can register through UA Online, which is an online registration if you've taken classes before. Otherwise, you contact the registrar's office to get set up. We also have a Southeast Alaska Native song and dance class on Saturdays if you just want to learn how to sing and dance, and there's language in there. And, you know, and the last thing I want to add is we've had people stepping up and saying, I know there's people in the community who want to go but cannot afford it. And we've had people who have been just saying, you know, this is for a student. And they give us like $700, and we tell a student, you know, somebody had just paid for you to be here. And that awakens something in that student as well to say, you know, wow, somebody else feels that it's important that I do this. And so we're seeing students who are taking a tremendous amount of responsibility, and they're succeeding. You know, it's taking a lot of hard work, and, you know, there's a lot of unknown things out there, but the courage they're showing and just committing themselves to becoming speakers is spectacular.
Well, thank you, Lance, so much for being on the show and talking about these very, very important Alaska Native language classes. Thanks a lot, Lance.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, up next we have Writer's Almanac.
And this is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday, August 29th, 2013. It's the birthday of British philosopher John Locke, born in Somerset, England in 1632. He believed in natural law and that people have natural rights, under which the right of property is the most important. He wrote, "Every man has a property in his own person. This, nobody has any right to but himself." He believed governments exist to protect those rights, and he argued in favor of revolt against tyranny. His ideas were a foundation for much of the Declaration of Independence and the United States Constitution. And it's the birthday of poet Tom Gunn, born in Gravesend, Kent, in 1929. He's known for his book Fighting Terms, a collection of poetry described by the critic John Press as a post-war volume all serious poetry readers need to study. As an undergraduate, Tom Gunn left Cambridge for Stanford University and eventually made San Francisco his home during the Beat Movement. He gave up a tenured position at Berkeley in the 1960s because he couldn't stand going to department meetings. He went on to publish many collections of poetry, including Touch, The Passages of Joy, and The Man with Night Sweats. It's the birthday of jazz saxophonist Charlie Parker, born in Kansas City, Kansas in 1920, considered one of the half dozen greatest jazz musicians, right up there with Duke Ellington and Louis Armstrong. Before Parker's innovations, jazz meant swing, melodies played at dance tempos by musicians in big orchestras who never got to take solos for very long. Late at night, after their big band jobs were over, Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, and other musicians kept on playing, improvising long lines at blazing speed. Parker used a lot of flatted fifths, and jazz players used the word bebop to mean a flatted fifth. But Parker didn't like to use the word for the way he played. "Let's not call it bebop," he said. "Let's just call it music." And here's a poem by Paul Zimmer entitled Dog Music. Amongst dogs are listeners and singers. My big dog sang with me so purely, puckering her ruffled lips into an O, beginning with small, swallowing sounds like Coltrane musing, then rising to power and resonance, gulping air to continue, her passion and sense of flawless form, singing with me, but mostly for the art of dogs. We joined in many fine songs, Stardust, Naima, The Trout, Jeg Elsker Dig, Perdido. She was a great master and died young, leaving me with unrelieved grief, her talents known only to a few. Now I have a small dog who does not sing, but listens with discernment, requiring skill and spirit in my falsetto voice. When I sing her name and words of love, Andante con brio, vivace, adagio, at times she is so moved she turns to place her paw across her snout, closing her eyes, sighing like a girl I held and danced with years ago. But I am a pretender to dog music. Indeed, few strains rise only from the rich red chambers of a canine heart. These melodies best when the moon is up, listeners and singers together and apart, beyond friendship and anger, far from any human impostor. Songs of bones, turds, conquests, hunts and scents, ballads of long nights lifting to starlight. Dog Music, a poem by Paul Zimmer from his collection Crossing to Sunlight Revisited, published by the University of Georgia Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation. You can turn your iPhone or Android into a virtual poetry library with the Poetry Foundation's Poetry app, available to everyone online at poetryfoundation.org/mobile. This is Billy Collins for the Writer's Almanac, hoping you will join us here next time.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon. I'm your host, Lisa Fu, and right now we have Nancy DeCherney in the studio. She's a regular guest. Hi, Nancy.
Hey, how are you? Nice to meet you.
So, art's up. What's up with arts?
Well, you know, it's a busy week. It's Labor Day weekend. We've got a couple of things going on tonight. There's a couple of meetings that might be really important for people. There's a meeting about the Willoughby Arts District that's over at the Prospector. I think it's at 4 or 4:30. I can't remember. And there's one out at the Forest Service headquarters about the Mendenhall commercial use. That's at 6 o'clock. So if you're interested in those things, go there. Friday, it is, let's see, we've got the UAS is having walk-in movies.
Oh, cool.
Does that sound like fun? It's a noise pavilion, and they just come right out and say, dress for it. So, but they will have popcorn, it says. So it's free for UAS students, and guests are $5. They're showing Now You See Me. On Saturday, it is the annual, I think this is a sixth annual food festival over at the Jack. This is free. It's from 9 in the morning until 2. We have all sorts of things happening and coming. There's workshops, and I'll just run through them real quickly.
Wait, can we get back to the food festival for a second?
Yeah.
So tell me more about this.
I am.
Okay.
We're
okay.
Still there.
Okay, workshops. Okay, good.
In connection with the food festival, we have some workshops about food. At 9:15, your favorite breakfast food, sauerkraut. So, Sarah Lewis will talk about how to make sauerkraut, which is a really nice way to preserve cabbages and this sort of thing. At 10 o'clock, Darren Snyder will be talking about gardening with kids. At 10:45, Emily Kane will be talking about kitchen medicine, things you can find in your own kitchen. Lewis Dorshak at 11:30 talking about pest management. And this was a topic that was requested last year for people in their gardens. Mark Cozy from Haynes, who's known as the Fungi, he will be doing a session on foraging. He does a lot of that himself, so he'll be talking about that. And Ed Byarski at 1 o'clock will talk about how to overwinter your fuchsias, dahlias, and begonias.
Oh, great.
So among the things that are coming, I was Mark from Haynes wanted to let me know, let everybody know that the birch syrup folks are going out of business, and this will be the last opportunity to get the birch syrup from Haynes. He's bringing down what he has. And so come on in for that. We have Wild Oven there. Jerry Donahue is going to be going around. He got a special grant from the Alaska Department of Agriculture to cook food right there, Alaskan-grown stuff. And he'll be showing, giving out recipes and showing you how to prepare things.
Wow.
Root Cellar Farms is there, Naturally Juno, Riverside Herbs, Casey Shattuck, the sherbet people with the rhubarb, they're going to be there. Misty Vinzant, she's usually got jams and all sorts of stuff. Chef Steph, the Community Garden, Balls of Bliss. Capital City Food Co-op, Ed's Edibles. I mean, the list goes on. You can get your rotary bulbs, all sorts of stuff. Pinky's Fish Market, Breezy Street will be there, so barbecue. Lots of fun things, and the whole thing is free. So do come over and enjoy that on Friday or Saturday morning. That's from 9 a.m. to 2 at the Jack. At 9 p.m., it is Rattle Trap Ruckus, which is a four-piece instrumental band from Bellingham. They'll be at Rockwell. It's a $10 ticket advance. And by the way, it's the Labor Day Regatta. The Seas folks are doing that.
Yes.
Start out at Taku Harbor on Saturday morning. On Sunday, the weekly ukulele jam over at Rockwell's. And at 6:30 p.m., it's Music on the Fly. It's Dan Hobson playing in the, he'll be in the airport baggage claim area. He's about to release a brand new CD. So, an opportunity to visit with Dan and listen to Dan out at the airport. At 7:30, it is on Sunday, Juno Jazz and Classics Made in America with Zool Bailey on cello and Laura Downs on piano. And this is, I don't know if you've heard Zool play, but it's, I love cello, and he's particularly wonderful at it. So you can get tickets at Hearthside or at the Jack or online or whatever. On Monday, it's Labor Day, and the Jack will be open. So if you find yourself rambling around with nothing to do, stop in. But it is a wonderful, you know, end of summer kind of holiday. On Wednesday at 8 p.m., UAS has Comedy Night featuring MTV's Kayvon. This is at the UAS Rec Center.
Wow.
It's free for UAS students and $5 for guests. The coming weekend has got Petersburg is having a rainforest festival, and it's also you're getting ready for Klondike. So
yes, people are getting ready for that. Yeah, there's a lot more runners.
Yeah,
and
what are they doing out there? They should have been practicing all along. So anyway, it's a really nice weekend, lots of wonderful music and lots of fun things to do, and I hope to see you at the Jack.
Thank you so much, Nancy, for that Arts Up update. Just so much going on over Labor Day weekend. We are going to just listen to some Zool Bailey, who will be here performing this weekend.
Juno Afternoon will be back tomorrow afternoon, Friday at 3, with Pat Moore as the host. She'll talk with instructors from UAS about the School of Management courses. We'll learn about Africa's Irkira School. John Bennett will be here to highlight the need for foster families. We'll talk to the people behind Bellingham's Alternative Library, That Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, Music, and more tomorrow on a Juno Afternoon KTOO News. This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valley and Auk Bay area, tuned to K276 AF 103.1. In Lemon and Sweitzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201 AM 88.1. K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. An Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait hear KTOO on K210 AS 89.9. In Juneau, you can also receive KTOO on GCI cable Juneau on digital channel 871. KRNN can be heard at digital channel 872, and KXLL can be found at 873. We're also online at www.ktoo.org. Thanks for listening to a Juno Afternoon, KTOO. I'm Lisa Fu. Up next is All Things Considered.
British Prime Minister David Cameron loses a vote to endorse military action in Syria.
After the vote, he said, Parliament, reflecting the will of the British people, does not want to see military action.
For Thursday, August 29th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News.